Hi! Welcome to Someone Else's Movie. I'm your genial host, Norm Wilner, and this is a one-on-one interview format with a filmmaker, critic, actor, or industry watcher about one specific film they want people to rediscover. Not a movie they're involved with, a movie they want to put back into the conversation. It can be a recent theatrical release that's just arrived on disc, an older film that's just popped back up on Netflix, a classic or a newish classic that's just come back in a special edition, as long as it's available somehow, somewhere to be watched, legally. Come on, guys. It's a candidate for the show. This episode, we're looking at a Stone classic, Bill Murray and Howard Franklin's 1990 comedy Quick Change. Amazingly, despite being an almost perfect heist picture, it's been treated fairly callously by Warner Home Video over the years, probably because it rolled over and died in its original theatrical slot, earning just $15 million domestically in a summer full of blockbusters like Dick Tracy and Die Hard 2. You can find it in high definition on Amazon Video, but it has yet to be released on Blu-ray, and its DVD edition is best described as, let's say, grudging. And yet, none of that matters. The movie has a scrappy energy that simply will not be denied, and it rewards repeat viewings masterfully. I can attest to that. I just watched it again a couple of weeks ago, and it's still a delight. Quick Change is championed by Aaron Abrams, an actor, writer, and producer you may remember from Slings and Arrows, Rookie Blue, Young People Fucking, and The L.A. Complex, the latter two of which he also co-wrote with director Martin Gero. He's currently shooting his third season as Brian Zeller on Hannibal, and no, he would not give me Will Graham's home address. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie.
This is cool. This is like you're the first person I don't actually personally know to be doing this.
Right. Yeah. So this is how we are meeting technically.
Yeah, we are.
We're going to meet and discuss a movie.
We passed in a hallway at TIFF, I'm quite sure. The year you were there with Young People Fucking, mm-hmm. the film you co-wrote, co-star in, and which people should, is it on streaming services?
It's a whole thing. No. It's a whole thing because the company folded, and so it was up on Netflix for a while, and now it's disappeared.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Sort of wrapped up in litigation and things like that.
Jesus. So
it's very tough to find.
I have the Blu-ray, so if anybody wants to borrow it,
sure, or legally download
on Twitter.
I'm sure there's online where you could do that.
I think that I would actually worry about searching for something called Young People.
Oh yeah, good luck with that. Good luck with that. Who knows what you're gonna get if you illegally download that?
Even if you put the asterisk in there, you're asking for trouble.
Sure.
So the film we're talking about is Quick Change, from 1990, co-directed by Bill Murray and Howard Franklin. If you haven't seen the film by the time you listen to this, please stop now, hit pause, go watch it. It's very short. We'll wait. It is one of those movies that somehow got lost, I guess is the way to describe it. It opened in the summer of 1990 and it tanked,
right.
Which is now inconceivable. Like, it's unimaginable to me that movie wasn't as big a hit as anything else that year.
I certainly haven't met anyone who doesn't have a soft spot in their heart for it, who has sought it out and found it and watched it.
Yeah. So how did you come to it first? What was your first experience of it?
Oh, when I was a kid, I mean, it's one of those movies that's sort of in the folds of my brain for whatever reason. I think those movies that are this movie and there's a movie called Let It Ride. So when you called to ask me about what movies to rewatch, the first movie that pops in my head is a movie called Let It Ride, because I have a weird fascination with that movie.
So this is the Richard Dreyfuss horse racing picture.
Right, which is a companion piece, I think, to this. They're both written by Jay Cronley, who is an author who I grew up reading. He wrote that and Let It Ride in a movie called Funny Farm with Chevy Chase.
Right.
And they're all sort of a person running into 1,000 characters, like crazy characters, in one day. So, Quick Change is basically Bill Murray is a thief, or basically comes in to rob a bank dressed as a clown, and succeeds with the help of Randy Quaid and Gina Davis, and then basically all he has to do is get away.
Yeah.
Just leave New York, and everything, all these crazy characters in New York sort of accidentally become obstructions, and it's sort of just a wild one day of him meeting crazy characters.
Yeah, and it is it's incredibly well cast. You can start with Murray, Quaid, and Davis, who are just remarkable together and have a fantastic chemistry. And now, of course, in the rearview mirror, Randy Quaid more or less appears to be playing himself in the first half instead of in the second.
That's right. He has a huge beard and he's acting like a crazy person. That's correct.
Just this madman. What do they call him? A crazy lumberjack?
Crazy lumberjack. They keep referring to him as the crazy lumberjack.
And then you have the opposite number, which is Jason Robards in one of his last like leading performances, more or less. He's effectively the Tommy Lee Jones.
Sure, and he comes in and just does so much work based on his reputation of just being like, I'm good at my job, I'm going to be a very tough antagonist for everybody because I'm good at my job and I'm Jason Robards.
Yeah.
So he has to do very little legwork to set up. It's almost perfect casting in that way.
Yeah, and the economy of the film is something that strikes me every time. I mean, it wastes absolutely no time. It opens with him, with Murray getting off the subway, getting on and getting off the subway to rob the bank.
Yeah.
It ends the second the story stops. I mean, there isn't even a breath.
Opening is the perfect, like just Bill Murray in a clown suit with that mush of his. On a subway, being kind of miserable. That's the thing about this movie. So when you told me to rewatch a movie, I think that this movie is the perfect rewatch movie. One of the reasons is if you are a fan of modern day Bill Murray, sad sack Wes Anderson, Lost in Translation Bill Murray, that is not reflected in necessarily Groundhog Day or Stripes or Ghostbusters or Scrooge. Right? Those are sort of wild men sleaze bags.
Yeah, they're bigger.
The origin bigger story of modern day Bill Murray is Quick Change Bill Murray. That's, if you want to go back and look at where new Bill Murray came from, I feel like Quick Change is the one where it greatly reflects where he ended up. He's sort of where he's this character that's a nice guy who has been beaten down by the world and sort of wears that on his face, and his heart is beating just a little bit. And you just hold, the struggle is to get it beating more by the end of the movie. That's St. Vincent, you know, yeah. Bill Murray in Lost Transition movie. And that's why it's a great movie to go back and look at. And it seems to be a movie that he was had a personal attachment to. I mean, he directed it and
yeah.
I think he's he's not, he wrote it, I think.
I'm sure he worked on it. I don't think that he takes a screen credit.
Right. And so there's something very personal about this movie for him. And this is, feels like more the first glimpse into who he actually is, or who he'll eventually become, at least.
Yeah, and what's strange to me about the way that it fared in 1990 is that just as in 1984 when he made the Razor's Edge, mm-hmm. the only other film he directed,
right,
and was also roundly resoundingly rejected by audiences and critics. Critics were okay on Quick Change. I think it just got,
yeah, it was good reviewed. It just didn't make any money.
Yeah,
I think
there's an intimacy to it that people responded to, which is also present in The Razor's Edge, but no one was willing to extend it to him.
Everyone wants to know Bill Murray a little bit. Everyone just wants to be close to Bill Murray, and so they'll take, you know, wild tap dancing, lounge singing Bill Murray, of course, mm-hmm. but they kind of want to get, and that's why there's, I mean, why do you think Bill Murray now is such a beloved figure? Like, it's almost, he's strangely beloved.
Yeah. I think it's because he maintains the eccentricity. He maintains the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Just the, you know, every 6 months you hear a story or you see the YouTube video of, oh, we slow walked through a room with Bill Murray and he
right.
was gracious enough to do it. I don't think he says yes a lot to anything. I mean, he's famously choosy about projects.
Super aloof.
He won't commit. He won't. Have you ever actually met him or
no? Never seen him. he's like a modern day Loki character.
He's
or something. He just like pops up in weird karaoke rooms or steals your pizza and runs down the street. Like
yeah.
it's these strange lores that make him who he's this weird also section of like he's one of us where he's like been beaten by the world and he's blue collar
mm.
and he's not Hollywood because he's so aloof, but also he's who we aspire to be. It's not like I believe him to be the happiest guy in the world. It's just that he's choosing to be the life of the party, or steal my pizza, or show up in a karaoke room, and which is what. So it's like this weird cross section of he's one of us, but he's also what we aspire to be.
Yeah.
It's like this weird cloudy lore of Bill Murray.
Yeah, he is. He is the. I think, yeah, Loki's an interesting way to put it. He is now a mythological figure.
Yes, that's
even
exactly
though
right.
he's a person.
Yeah.
I have yet to be in a room with him. I think I saw him around a corner once.
Even if you were in a room with him, I don't know if you would be feel like you were
I don't
in
know
a room
how
with
it would
him.
Work. Yeah. Everyone who I've ever met, who I've ever interviewed, who's about working with him, sat down with Melissa McCarthy at TIFF last year
uh-huh.
for St. Vincent, and she was just, she said the same thing that everybody says, and she said it in a really great way. She said, all you want to do is show him your trick. You want to say, this is my thing. Look, watch me be funny too. And then you realize, oh no, you just want to be in the moment with him. You actually don't want to show off because he can crush you.
Right.
You know going in he's bigger than you are.
Mm-hmm.
He's better than you are. Because he's Bill Murray and you've spent your entire life watching that. And so the thrill of work, she communicated it beautifully. She just said the thrill of working with him is that you actually realize, oh yeah, I'm in a scene with Bill Murray, but he's acting too. Like, he's not letting you do the work. He's not standing still. What he does right. is really specific.
I get that too. I get, because he's so sort of generally effortless that he's, it would put pressure on you to be like, well, I'm going to,
yeah.
Let me show you. And he's just, you can't do that.
Yeah.
I totally buy that. That's the big trap with him.
And you get the sense in Quick Change, too, that every single actor is responding to the opportunity. Not mm-hmm. to work with him, because it's 25 years ago, and he was a legend, but he wasn't a legend. He wasn't, mm-hmm. you know, superhuman yet. But you've got, like, maybe the second best cast assembled for an American comedy that decade after Galaxy Quest.
That's the other reason why this is a great rewatch movie is, you know,
every
guy who pops up for a scene is somebody who turned out to be a big time deal.
Yeah, I think
they're hitting home runs.
This was my first watch of it. We watched it a couple of weeks ago. And it was my first watch of it where I didn't recognize a new face. Like, nobody has broken since.
Yeah.
Since the last time.
You've now tapped it.
Yeah. Well, but, it's like, oh, Stanley Tucci and Tony Shalhoub.
Who are insanely funny in this movie for their limited parts. I mean, there's, you watch it, I imagine you watched it at a time, you're like, well, there's no way this guy's not going to be a big deal and have his own show and win Emmys at someday. Like, bluff only. Like, it's just, he doesn't do anything except for be hilarious. And Stanley Tucci's...
Yeah, he's incredible.
It's just incredible.
It's the only time I think I've ever seen him with his hair like that.
I know.
And it's clearly for the part. You know, it's like, no, don't do anything. Just, you come in, we won't put a piece on you.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, to have that on, just be like, oh, weaselly sidekick guy or for the mob and mm-hmm. play it that way, where he's just such a weak-willed wuss. Yeah. He's so funny in it.
Well, all right. Just the fact that there's someone else that he's more scared of. Instantly, who isn't. And it's another great way of introducing, because, first of all, you've got, it's Bruno, right? Bruno's the enforcer.
Mario.
Mario's on his way. Mm-hmm. But they're like, don't bring that animal Mario back. And then you also have Lambino, who hovers over this film throughout.
That's right.
Once he's introduced, he's the big bad that turns out to, of course, be... Well, if you're still listening, I'm assuming you've watched.
I think we're allowed to spoil Quick Change.
And Kurtwood Smith being Lambino mm-hmm. as Mr. Russ Crane is also, like, he's become a reverse heavy, because at the time, this was 3 years after RoboCop, and there was no one who didn't go, oh, that guy.
Yeah, right, exactly.
That's the guy from RoboCop. He kills people. He looks like an accountant, but he kills people. And then you get that 70s show, and he suddenly became a comic actor. I mean, he always was a really versatile character actor. But to watch it now is this weird sort of window back in time where Kurtwood Smith isn't playing... Like, he's playing a light comic role, but he's bringing the weight of RoboCop with him, except he's not anymore, because now there's everything else he's done.
Well, there's a certain aspect, like, and even Tony Shalhoub and Stanley Tucci are great actors first. Mm. They're not, like, Bill Murray didn't pile it on with comedians. You can even say, like, Rich Gian Davis as well. Sure. Randy Quaid's dramatic work is pretty underrated,
I think.
And so you have these guys, he didn't flood it with just sort of joke-sniping comedians who come in. I think with movies like this, where you have to have an adventure where it's basically you're cobbling together six to eight weird set piece, mm-hmm. strange events that happen. You have to introduce whole full characters that are fully realized in seconds, and then develop a huge problem around fully developed characters. And that's what works so well, I think, one of the reasons it works so well, is that Stanley Tucci is so great, and Tony Shalhoub and Phil Hartman.
Yeah.
I mean, these aren't just... like, Phil Hartman was a Saturday Night Live guy, but he was always beyond a Saturday Night Live guy. Like, he was fully formed characters on Saturday Night Live, was kind of his whole bit.
He's like an inhabitor.
Yeah, that's right. And the bus driver, I forget his
Philip
name.
Philip Bosco,
which is
an amazing performance, because it's actually drier than Murray.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't until this viewing that I realized, oh, that's why. That's what makes it so funny, is because neither of them is raising their voice, and then it's Murray who cracks. Because, again, he's orchestrated structurally. We get to the point where the thing that finally cracks him, the thing that finally sets him off, is someone who's even calmer than he is.
That's right. That's exactly right.
In the middle of this insane juggernaut, I stop near the airport. It's such a magnificent line, because absolutely. It gives you nothing.
And there's something... egoless about it as well. Like, as you say, Bill Murray is technically playing the straight man for everybody in this movie. He's the funniest thing in the movie because he's Bill Murray, but he's also to put himself there and just be like, I'm just going to be a reactor for people. It's sort of exactly what you want from a Bill Murray, an old Bill Murray movie. It's not him going crazy and necessarily yelling and screaming at everything. It's just him looking at a crazy person with his deadpan face and saying the perfect line.
Yeah, finding out the one the one thing to poke a situation. Because yeah. It really is. I mean, it's a... There's a Bugs Bunny quality to some of it.
Sure.
Except that Bugs is never on the losing end of an argument. Mm-hmm. And Murray loses... Like, Grimm loses a bunch of them in this film.
And it has that innocence to it where I think it's a time capsule where comedies... There's no edge in this movie at all.
Yeah.
And you don't notice that until the... It's not a... It doesn't make the movie lacking in any way. There's a few things that I think make this movie different than, like, now, where I think modern-day comedies have a freneticness where they're, like, afraid that you're going to stop watching, so just piling on with energy. So it's both juvenile and sort of got lots of sort of dark moments that pop up. These, like, Will Ferrell and Kevin Hart or whoever. I mean, those movies have a certain energy to them. This movie, they don't make movies like this anymore. They're sort of sitting back and just... allowing you to lean forward into it as opposed to sort of throwing energy out at you.
Yeah. Well, the mechanism of the film is very much the thing that's entertaining. It's the, like, structurally, it seems like it would be incredibly complicated. There are a lot of locations. Once they leave the bank, it doesn't really stay anywhere for more than 6 or 7 minutes. It just flies through different place, every different situation. But the way that it still confines itself. I mean, it feels very claustrophobic because of the desperation of the three leads who simply want to get out of New York City. And I would have thought that was ridiculous, but there was a point, I was in New York for a press junket, I want to say 93 or 94, and I couldn't get a cab to LaGuardia. I was in Times Square and I couldn't get a cab out because the shift change had happened. And it wasn't until it actually, you know, there's this window in New York City inevitably between 4 and 6 p.m. where the cab shifts change and they don't want to go on a long ride because they won't get home for another hour and a half.
Right.
It adds on more time. So I had a guy actually tell me, oh, I don't know the way to LaGuardia in Times Square. And I was like, I'm pretty sure I could get you there. But that was that's the obstinacy, that the sheer blunt force lying.
There seems to be something very real behind Bill Murray actually hating New York.
Yeah,
you get the feeling that he does not. This is New York is the total villain of the piece. And you get the feeling that Bill Murray is relishing the fact that he's making New York look like the shithole he believes it to be.
Yeah, and this is pre-Disney, pre-Giuliani. This is the old crumbling infrastructure hellhole of New York, where at the time, I mean, I was there around the same time, and I love it. I love it now. It's the happiest place on earth,
sure,
as it were. But you could feel the sense of just the sheer impatience of it not being better. Everybody in Quick Change is reacting on the same thing, which is like, I have my thing to do.
And nobody cares about anybody else.
Yeah. And even the construction work is like, today's just taking shit down, tomorrow's putting shit up.
That's right.
The sheer lack of attention to anything other than the task at hand, and people are like, that lady's been screaming at us, she got her baby to scream at us. Like, it's an affront.
That's right, yeah. Like, everybody's personally offended at everybody else for no reason. And there's also this idea of scumminess that... You know, they get on the bus and there's that lady who's just shaving the guy's head.
Yeah.
You can't, if you were to put that in a movie today, or like, be like, this is what New York is, you'd have to stop and address, like, the fact that Bill Murray just walks past it while saying a line as a throwaway, captures what New York was that time, where it was just deviants and weirdos from top to bottom.
Yeah. There's that, and the weirdness that sort of bubbles up, too, and gets in the way of the characters as much as they get in the way of everyone else's day. There's that, just the sequence where they stumble on the jousters. And again, you know, the movie stops dead. It breathes for that moment. The music comes up. You have we get to watch their ritual before they actually do it. And then we figure out what's happening. It makes me laugh every time, even though I know exactly what's coming. I even know the music cue at this point. And it's just, there is this moment. Like, that feels more like Bill Murray's sensibility than anything else.
Absolutely.
I am going to make you watch this weird thing that I find fascinating for 90 seconds.
Yes. And then, all the people watching, like the lady with the rose and the beads, and the guy gets the bike and throws it down. It's just such a portrait that's very specific to the wackiness of Bill Murray that he can throw in this movie whenever he wants.
Yeah, and then it's echoed later with the Flowers for the Dead.
Which is
such a... Again, it comes out of another movie. It comes out of another influence. There's just this strange intrusion of something else, something totally other, that happens two or three times in the course of the film. And it's this weird glee in showing us the 90-degree angle from what we were seeing. Like, how their lives, for a moment, their story doesn't really matter because this is happening and everybody has to stop and watch. It's like being taken, like it's being taken by the hand, which is the thing that Jason Robards does a couple of times to the sidekick.
Oh, that's so weird that he does that. Yeah. It's great.
And it's like, it's a validation for him in a weird way. Like he's showing people that he's still working the case or he's still on it.
Yep.
But it feels so childlike and gleeful.
That's right.
And that, like, that's how I perceive Quick Change, is just you're being led along to all these individual moments by someone who can't wait to show you, not this one, but two down the road.
That also, yeah, and it keys into the mischievousness of Bill Murray,
yeah.
which we were talking about before, like when he has to pretend to be, he's playing a guy who has to pretend to be a dangerous bank robber. There's such a gleeful, like he's really enjoying it.
Yeah.
There's nobody commits harder to not being fully committed than Bill Murray. Like it's almost like winking to the camera, but not quite. I mean, him parading around pretending to be a crazy person in that bank, it's one of the greatest half hour. Like it's so funny to me, that opening half hour of him in a clown suit robbing a bank.
Yeah. And we know going in, between the music cues mm-hmm. and his timing, that there's no threat to anyone.
That's right.
And everyone else has to take it. I mean, the SWAT guys, like, in watching a movie set in New York pre-9/11, anything mm-hmm. is going to be a weird sort of disconnected
yeah, like
experience.
They were up 9 minutes before their flight.
Yeah.
And they're like, God, we got there.
That you
good.
Can walk onto a plane. And it's JFK, which is even, like, LaGuardia is hell on earth.
For sure. Me,
but JFK is still pretty hard to navigate. Just the idea that anything like that was possible. There is a reference to security. They'll never let us through the x-ray machines with our guns. It's like, yeah, no shit.
Yeah.
Can't take a gun to the airport.
Yeah. These terrorists made it real hard on us bank robbers.
Yeah. I'm still not even sure which terrorists they were referring to.
Right, right.
But that also kind of, there is a weird sort of timelessness to the apathy of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And how every time I go there, it feels like I should just stay because my cynicism matches its cynicism. And I still know, you know, you still know where to get a good hamburger. But it, the version of New York is like the sort of Murphy's Law universe where absolutely everything is going to go wrong. But the city can't break you if you've already decided to leave. That's, I think, like, that's what carries Murray out.
Interesting. Yes, yes. Well, that's the thing with these movies that have sort of one event over a night, that are sort of one wild night, is it seems like structurally you just have to string a bunch of events together, but it's kind of a lot more than that. You have to have sort of a theme underneath about why they want to leave that's constantly being reinforced. And then they have this B storyline where, you know, the personal relationships have to arc over the course of the night in this matching way, which I think they bounce that ball real good with, like, Gina Davis not sure about her relationship with Bill Murray. These movies are weirdly complex. I think especially when you rewatch them a few times, like the first time you see them, you get wrapped up in the
sure.
joy of it. And then you watch it and you're like, this takes some work and some construction to actually make all these balls sort of float around all at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I think about Scorsese's After Hours.
Yes,
it's
a perfect example.
Great compression New York movie.
That's right.
Which was only, what, like 4 years earlier, but completely different emotionally.
See, yeah.
Or 5 years earlier, because it was 85. Emotionally, it's just harrowing. People die. And it's still funny.
Yes.
But it's like a completely different desperation. And it's the opposite. He just wants to get home. He wants to get out of Soho.
Right.
Or the Lower East Side. And at a time, like even 4 years later and 5 years later when they made Quick Change, it's a different New York. Again, like the sort of the Blank City Revolution had already happened and the gentrification was just starting. And, you know, Giuliani hadn't arrived yet, but they were going to clean up all the homeless people and turn them into hot dogs and do whatever it is that he did.
Is that true?
We still don't know. There's like a great, weird, cynical horror movie to be made about the gentrification of
that's
New York
hilarious.
City.
That's hilarious.
And it was a year after Do the Right Thing and Ghostbusters 2, two very different visions of
New
York.
York.
And Ghostbusters 2, like, it's people don't like it as much, I guess. You can say that
I
fairly.
I certainly don't.
I think there's some really great ideas in it.
And, sure, listen.
But the vision of New York City, I think, is what, in a weird way, I feel like Murray had that in his back pocket when he was working on Quick Change, because in Ghostbusters 2, like, the whole thing is the hostility of New York City creating more ghosts and making the slime angry mm-hmm. and all the other stuff happening. And it ends with this big, ridiculous set piece. The big finale of Ghostbusters 2 is the guys riding the Statue of Liberty into New York City because of the slime that's making everyone sing Your Love Is Lifting Me Higher. And it is so preposterous and ludicrous that, like, you can just see Murray going, yeah, I have a better idea.
Yeah. Well, New York is sort of the perfect set piece and villain just because everyone's familiar with it and everyone has a relationship with it. And if you love it, the thing you love about it is that it's a difficult pain in the ass.
Yeah.
You can still paint it as a pain in the ass bad guy in your movie, like Murray does, and assuming Murray isn't a huge fan of New York, let's say. But, I mean, you can make it there, you can make it anywhere, is something New Yorkers love about their city. That is not a compliment. That's like...
That's right.
It's basically saying that this city is going to try and beat the shit out of you at all the time. Yeah. I don't know. Can I swear on this thing?
Yeah, sure. Great. We have the explicit tag going.
Okay, good.
But yeah, it fits in really well. No one ever talks about Quick Change in the same window of cinema as the other two great New York heist pictures, the Taking Pelham 1-2-3
mm-hmm.
and Dog Day Afternoon. But it really, I mean, they're very, very similar.
He's seen. Yeah, Quick Change is really hitting those. He's like, you like those movies? Well, this is that, only filled with joy.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
They really feel, Dog Day Afternoon, clearly, I mean, it's very direct. And Taking Pelham 1-2-3, I mean, just Walter Matthau's face and Bill Murray's face have this, I mean, it's very similar sort of hangdog, like, well... Yeah. Here we are.
I always assumed that the subway was a deliberate... Like, the fact that he takes the subway at the beginning of the film was a deliberate homage, even if it's only because, you know, you're carrying explosives. You don't want to get in a cab for some reason. Like,
right.
He would distrust cabs on Park Avenue for whatever reason. It's just there's this sort of working-class misery to it, to the point where in the film, like, we never even find out what it is he does. There's an allusion to him working as a city planner.
Yes.
But he's clearly smarter than that, or he's been trapped in kind of that level of job.
Yes.
But it doesn't even matter. Like, that's the Bill Murray aspect of it.
It's really on his face that whatever he's been doing, it's A, beneath him, and B... he's been beaten up by it.
Yeah.
He's just weary with the world. And it's no one does that better than him. It's just great to put him into places. And he just takes you by that. He makes you feel better. If what you like about Bill Murray is you feel better at the end of a Bill Murray movie, this is, I think, again, the origin of that, where he's like, just hang out with me. It's not like Scrooge, where he starts off as a maniacal sleazebag and then ends up singing Christmas carols at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
He's the same guy from the beginning to the end. It's just a small difference, and that's much more modern-day Wes Anderson, Bill Murray.
Yeah, I'm thinking, actually, the stuff that he made between Quick Change and Rushmore, and it's ultimately...
It's like supporting guys now.
Yeah, a couple of leading roles. Well, there's Groundhog Day, obviously,
sure.
Still 2 years out. But then after that, there's... The Man Who Knew Too Little and
right.
Larger
That's
Than
with
Life.
These guys, too, I think, right? Isn't that with Franklin again?
I think it might have been, yeah. And you can just... His heart's not in it. It's not a bad movie. It's kind of a weird...
He seems to be finding himself a little bit.
Charming,
where he's like,
little...
Oh, this is what people want, but I don't know. Am I a guy who's just like... there's something wound up about all those characters that doesn't feel like he's into doing that anymore.
Yeah, you feel like he's moved on. I mean, not in Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day is a great... kind of valedictory performance of old Bill Murray stuff.
Sure.
It's the it's like the salad bar. You get every single part of him that you like, and you can leave the stuff behind that doesn't work.
But he was notoriously miserable during Groundhog Day.
I still don't understand that. Yeah, he and Ramis had a falling out. They didn't speak to each other
so
for years.
So strange. I guess he just did. I mean, I don't know. We cannot know the shadows and mysteries of Bill Murray.
It's fascinating that this, just by the fact that he directed this, co-directed this, and directed The Razor's Edge, those are his personal films. Like, those are the films that we can read into and search for meaning. I mean, that's my thing.
Absolutely.
Like, as an auteurist critic, I have to look for reasoning and choices. And at the same time, yeah, they're unknowable. There's clearly a very specific sense of humor at work, and there's a sense of irony that he loves in both The Razor's Edge and Quick Change. But Quick Change, as you say, it's a film about joy. It's a film about sharing. These are all my favorite things. These are the actors I'm having the most fun playing with.
Mm-hmm.
Even just that weird little scene where he waits for someone to count change and bills in the bodega. That is... There's no way that's over in a minute and a half. And there's a ticking clock that's you have 78 seconds, sir.
It's really bizarrely long.
And it just goes on and on and on, but it's so pleasurable.
And he even edits that in a way where there's like a good 20 seconds where he's just staring at the woman in front of him.
Yeah.
And it's so funny.
It is.
I was like, this shouldn't... The pace of this should not allow for a Bill Murray unblinking stare at a slow lady. But it's... I mean, you had to have it in there.
Yeah. No, it's a... There's a... This magnificent pleasure of this film.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's over in 89 minutes. There's not an ounce of fat on it, which is incredible. Films by actors tend to be pretty long because they like performances. They keep things, not necessarily their own, but you can feel people filmmakers responding to an emotion, to an honest moment, and just doing everything they can to make that moment last here and there. Quick Change is merciless. Like, it just doesn't have time for anything that doesn't support the plot, and yet it's so full at that tiny little 89-minute window.
Because it has an easiness. It almost feels, you know, Bob Elliott is plays the security guard, and he's like got he's an old time sort of comedic sensibility, and there's an idea of like a craftsmanship to the jokes. There's nothing, it's not fast and loose, like you know, I love comedies today. I think we're in a golden age of comedy, but you look at Judge Apatow movies or any of these like Kristen Wiig or Will Ferrell, whoever, or Vince Vaughn, they're everything's fast and loose, and that's sort of what we get off on. But here it's not, there's nothing loose, but nothing feels tight either. It's just sort of like craftsman. Every scene has arcs to a joke, comes back down. Like, it's there's no fat anywhere. And that's why it's sort of a just a, like, I don't want to say gentle, but there's something so easy about watching it that feels so refreshing now.
Yeah.
That maybe at the time felt edgeless or flaccid or something. I don't know why people didn't go see it. It didn't have a hook. Like, I don't know how you sell this movie, maybe, in a trailer. But when you watch it now, there's something so new and exciting about it.
Yeah, there's, I mean, I remember the poster was so minimalist. It was just,
I had it in my room.
Yeah, just the him, the clown makeup.
Yeah, it was just a white poster with him standing with the balloon. I can't tell if the balloon might have been deflated, and just had their names in huge font. Yeah. Four names. And that was the whole poster.
Yeah, and it opened, what, 2 weeks after Dick Tracy, and no one had any time for it. It just got... Right. And Die Hard 2 was that summer.
I remember reading an interview with him where he was like talking about what Warren Beatty had to do to sell Dick Tracy, and he was like, I'm not doing that. Like, he just was like, look at what this guy has to do. Like, this guy is a amazing filmmaker, but he has to run around and go on every talk show. Like, that's not fair to him. Just go see Dick Tracy. Like, what? I'm not going to do that for Quick Change. It's a good movie.
Yeah. Well, it is. He was right.
Absolutely. Totally right.
25 years later, which is unthinkable to me. It is a quarter century. Like, this summer is the 25th anniversary of a lot of movies that feel pretty fresh in my mind. Because I would have been 22 when Quick Change came out, and it's hard to wrap that my head around that. We've all grown up. The movie hasn't really aged, because other than cell phones and you know, more sophisticated televisions,
yeah.
You could Uber it. You could Uber your way home.
Easy.
Although now someone will try to remake. There'll be like a webcam comedy version of an Uber.
Oh, God.
Trying to get out of town. Someone's probably already done it. Actually, Broad City has a great episode about trying to get out of New York.
Oh, yeah.
No bank robbery situation. But in the first season, the characters are trying to leave for a wedding. And they start by going to the wrong train station. They go to Grand Central and they should go to Penn. And it's steeped in the misery of public transit and the sense of desperation that comes with knowing you can't afford to take a cab.
Right.
And that's something that you can do when you're in your 20s.
I think that's also why Snowpiercer I liked so much. I was like, all right, yeah, trains are the worst. Yes, I missed the whole point of the movie, but the class system, I was like, oh, trains, though, guys, trains, am I right?
And you can never get off.
So cramped.
The one thing about Snow, you know, like, somebody really needs to do a smell version of Snowpiercer.
Like a scratch and
sniff. Those people must have been foul.
Oh, yeah.
It hit me. There's a point, somebody was telling me, it might have even been Evans, actually. The level of, small digression, the level of costume that they had to come up with for Chris Evans, because these characters are all supposed to be emaciated. They've been on the train together for 17 years. They're subsisting on cockroach bars.
Right.
Spoiler for Snowpiercer. And Evans came right off the Avengers. So he's built. He's huge. In fact, when he in the tag at the Avengers where they're all eating shawarma at the end, he has to keep his hand over his face the entire thing because they glued on a fake face. This he talked about on an episode of Doug Loves Movies.
What?
Well, he had a beard, and Cap doesn't have a beard.
Oh.
So he couldn't shave the beard because he came in from Snowpiercer to shoot this little tag.
Oh.
And so he actually at one point, you can see it, if you're looking for it, it's really obvious, he moves his hand even further over the shawarma he's holding to his face to cover the possibility that this fake skin thing they grafted over him might show through.
That's hilarious.
So he's this huge guy dressed in like three layers of everything, and he was smothering the whole time because it was not a cold set.
I feel like this is the kind of thing that never happened in the movies of the 90s, the early 90s.
Yeah.
There was no CGI beards.
Yeah.
There's something about it almost, it almost feels like a play or something, like just like a fun, it's like a review or something. There's something Catskills-y about Quick Change.
Well, they must have rehearsed the crap out of it,
too. That's, yeah.
Because there's just no, like, it's everything is so interconnected and so desperately, you know, one joke piled on top. The timing of that thing is, it is a Swiss watch. A Swiss watch is fantastic.
Right.
And I wonder what you were saying about comedies getting more flaily and looser and wilder. Mm-hmm. I just suspect it's digital. I think when you have unlimited stock, right, you can just keep throwing lines at people.
Alt lines, and you can work it out in the editing room. There's nothing worked out in the editing room in this movie. I mean, there's walk and talks that have ebbs and flows. Like, it's not, the jokes aren't being formed in the editing room. They're clearly work on the floor. And that's another thing. I mean, it's another reason to watch this movie. Everybody should be watching this movie.
I agree completely. So before we check out, I want to do the basic artist inquiry. I have no idea what we're going to end up calling this segment, but what fascinates me about the people's, everyone who I've approached for this so far has given me a choice I wouldn't have seen coming. So is there something about it that you use as an actor, as a writer? Is there something you rely on? I mean, like
From Quick Change?
Or something you learned from it?
I can't...
Even unconsciously.
Certainly, like when I rewatch, I rewatched this week, and we've got a couple scripts now that have been optioned, and I was almost worried. I was like, oh, I didn't realize that this kind of bit is very reminiscent of this bit, and that, like, it's direct. They're both... Certainly, the city as a villain is something that when I write, LA Complex, which was a show that I was a writer and producer on, Los Angeles was the villain very much the same way New York was the villain.
Right.
And
well, the culture, I mean, it was basically a parasitic kind of relationship that every human being that came in would be eaten or diminished in
some way. That's right. And they come in with these big stars in their eyes, and Los Angeles is like, yeah, you've been lied to. That's not what happens.
Paul F. Tompkins will be mean to you.
Exactly.
But in you a really charming way.
Well, that's his way. and that's also in various other things that I've written. There's also something about just Bill Murray in general, this kind of Bill Murray. I think when people try to emulate or learn from the other, you know, Groundhog Day is not a thing that actors can necessarily learn from, because it's a different thing that he's doing. Not anybody can do that.
Yeah, it's the, what do they call it, the non-repeating phenomenon.
That's right. But the quiet resonance of Bill Murray is something that I'm always chasing, especially when, you know, I play a lot of guys who just talk too much, and there's something about him where he says so much without saying anything that you can... That's always what I'm trying to learn. That's why I knew Bill Murray is so fascinating to me, because he's wearing it so well. And that seems to be what he's always tried to do. So that's the other thing I sort of take from these movies. And just 90s comedies are so clean. And
yeah.
There's something about... You know, I think since Wedding Crashers, everybody feels like they can make their comedies better by making up a bunch of stuff, not realizing that Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson are fucking amazing at it, and that's not something that everybody should be doing. They're like, oh, this is the style, we do this now. And they're like, no, that's what they should be doing, because they can make it work. And that's not to say I can't, it's just that's become a crutch. It's swung so hard the other way that people are like, well, eventually we'll all keep talking until an editor can pick out a joke every once in a while.
Yeah.
And there's something about working up before we get there, rehearsing it, you know, to death, and trying to figure out how things work on the floor so that they can work on film and in the editing room, and so that it's you have a little bit more control over what's going to happen.
Yeah. And so the takeaway here, obviously, for people listening, is that Quick Change is great and people should see it. This is the first episode where I've agreed with somebody.
That's right. Yeah,
going in, because Anne's suggestion of American Hustle, I'm pretty sure, was just
a designed just a fight
to
with
fuck
you.
With me. Yeah, 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 just like, let's start off on a weird. Let's see what you can handle. But yeah, no, it is a delightful film. It's only available on DVD in North America. Somehow, there's been no Blu-ray release. Hopefully, this will, you know, at least push a button to push a button to push a button somewhere down the line and get people talking about it again. 25th anniversary Blu-ray can't be that hard. We'll find people.
Is it on Netflix?
I don't know. I looked for not on Netflix Canada when I looked.
Oh my god!
I had to pull out my old DVD, which is
that's what, know, I did too. It's ridiculous.
I'm hoping that, you know, everybody has it. I think it's one of those movies where people shouldn't have to look too hard for it, because hopefully you've already got it somewhere in one of those multi-pack Bill Murray packages from the late 90s or the early 2000s. Or
this and Let It Ride, and I bought three right away.
The third one you mentioned is the
Funny Farm.
Funny Farm is the only one that's on Blu-ray.
I don't like Funny Farm that much. I mean, I love Funny Farm, I love Jake Rowling, but it's, of the three, Let It Ride is the companion piece for this guy.
Yeah. It's Let It Ride's a good one.
Nobody likes it quite like I do. It's a weird, that's why I didn't want to come on here and start talking about Let It Ride. I just would get immediately, I would weird you out quick.
No. That's what I'm saying. Like, every single person who's come up with something for this has been a genuine surprise. And I love the idea of trying to work it into the filmography and figuring out, I mean, well, Quick Change, Young People Fucking is very vignette-y. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's going to be an economy of character that maybe he got from this, that kind of thing. But
there's something about that. Yeah, I think just economy of everything to sort of, if it works where there's no fat and it's clean and simple on the page, then maybe you can add weird looks. Or you certainly, that allows you to get away with things like jousting.
Right.
If you have if the script was madness, then you couldn't do jousting. And you'd have to make a meal of a guy getting his head shaved on the bus. You'd have to make a meal of the fact that it's all, so much of it is those Bill Murray throwaways. It really gets a look into his sensibility and just like a look on how things used to work once upon a time.
Yeah. I would like to believe that the takeaway from Quick Change is this is how Bill Murray sees the world. Like, every now and then he'll bumble into that.
Well, it certainly is a reason to rewatch it if your desire is to know more about Bill Murray, which seems to be everyone's desire.
I should say.
This is must-watch viewing.
Yeah.
This is an origin story for the superhero that is Bill Murray today.
Murray Man.
Murray Man.
Thanks to my guest, Aaron Abrams. You can find Aaron on Twitter at Mr. Aaron Abrams, that's M.R. Aaron Abrams, and on your television later this spring in the 8th episode of CSI Cyber. He's also in the 3rd season of Hannibal, which starts airing on NBC later this summer. I'd also suggest digging up a DVD or a Blu-ray of Young People Fucking, if you can find it, because it's really good. You can also find the L.A. Complex on DVD and in the U.S. on Netflix streaming. You can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also follow this podcast at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, or on our frankly amateurish webpage at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. This is a one-man operation, people. I'm apologizing in advance. It's going to be a bumpy ride, but I promise it'll be a little bit better next time. So thanks again for listening. Please come back. And if you did like the show, leave a review on iTunes. I hear that's a thing. Anyway, thanks very much. We'll see you next week.